Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way, flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire. In this episode, Manuela Grassani checks out the Asian cultural and intellectual roots of gameplay. Through an Indian elephant chess piece from the late 17th to early 18th century.
Buried in the collections of the New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, there is a small ivory statuette in the shape of an elephant. Placed on a fat, oval base and carved with bent knees and a curved trunk, this elephant seems frozen in time, captured mid-movement. Once, it carried a rider, but now only a pair of legs and a jutting bit of ivory on its back remain. Made in the late 17th to early 18th century India, our ivory elephant might not seem to have much to do with chess as we know it today in the Western world. This game, however, has a long history and tradition, one that exists mainly outside the confines of the geographical and political West, centering instead in and across Asia. A closer look at chess as a game that developed and transformed while moving through time and space reveals interesting notions about the societies it existed within. Chess in particular, but also all games, reflect and define the socio-political and cultural structures of society. Retracing the manifold history of chess helps us shed the many layers of European imperialist and orientalist bias that blur our understanding of Asian artistic and social histories. Picking up these pieces helps us better understand the agency of these cultures and the complexities of pre-modern global interactions. Deeper still, they enable us to question the very criteria Western history customarily uses to categorize time and civilizations. First known as Chaturanga, chess can be traced back to India and the Gupta dynasty, whose empire existed between the 3rd and 6th century CE. But mentions of earlier versions and predecessors of the game appear in ancient Sanskrit epics from the 3rd century BCE. This suggests that some ancestors of chess were already played long before the 6th century. Some of the rules of Chaturanga remain hazy. Still, we know that it was played on uncheckered boards of 64 or 100 squares, between two or four players, each wielding 16 pieces. Gameplay was most probably facilitated by dice, even though each piece was only able to move within prescribed patterns, much like they do today. An inescapable attack on the Raja, or king piece, was the only correct end to a match, as stalemates were considered a loss for all parties. Besides the Raja, each player had a counselor or minister, two charioteers, two war elephants, two soldiers on horseback, and eight soldiers on foot. Such a division of roles was a direct and explicit reenactment of the military setup of ancient Indian kingdoms and empires. Respectively representing chariotry, elephantry, cavalry, and infantry, each type of piece corresponded to a branch of the army, commanded by the king and his advisor. Ancient texts on warfare reveal that the ability of armies to move and act as one was already a core principle of imperial war theory. We can see this in the name of the game itself. Chaturanga means four-limbed, showing how the four divisions of the army were understood as extensions of the king's authority and power, and emphasizing that the goal was for all to function in a collective and concerted manner. The placement of pieces on the chessboard also reflected military thinking. It sought to recreate the army formations that were employed across imperial battlefields of Asia through the centuries. Chess was very much understood as a war game, a testing ground for kings and princes to learn and practice military strategy and imperial leadership skills. Played primarily in elite circles, it was also a way to perform legitimate authority through the subtle, leisurely activities that could take place in front of an assembled court. Around the early 7th century CE, Chaturanga moved westward to the imperial court of the Sassanid Persia. Here, too, it quickly became a pillar for princely education and elite culture. If we believe the story as recounted in manuscripts, the first chess set was introduced to the court of King Khosrow I by an Indian ambassador. He presented it as a challenge, inviting the Persian court to attempt to decode the role of each piece, the way they moved, and the rules of the game. If they couldn't figure it out, the Indian Raja would no longer need to pay the tribute he owed to the Sassanid king. However, after a day and night, the clever Persian vizier arrived at the solution and thus secured his tribute. This tale tells us how complex diplomatic relations between East and West Asia existed, completely distinct from Western involvement. But it also highlights how objects, ideas, and knowledge transformed as they moved across the continent. Chaturanga was adapted once it arrived in Persia. It became known as shatranj, and the pieces morphed into simpler, more stylized shapes. The intricately carved Indian figurines of war elephants were simplified to cylindrical pieces with two frontal protuberances, perhaps referencing tusks. Similarly, soldiers on horseback were reduced to horse pieces, identifiable by their rectangular head shapes. Some rules were also added and amended. The Persians introduced the practice of warning the king when under attack with the expression shamat. Indeed, our current English term checkmate comes directly from the Middle Persian. Soon after arriving in Persia, chess was once more on the move. In the 7th and 8th centuries, Arab conquests swept across Asia, establishing one of the largest pre-modern empires in the world. Spanning from India in the east to Spain in the west, this expansionistic effort interconnected distant places even more than before. Islam was instated as a shared faith and common legal basis, and Arabic was used as a lingua franca, which increasingly facilitated and encouraged the movement of people, objects, and traditions. Chess was also carried along as part of the shared cultural milieu, leaving a distinctly Persian imprint even on the original Indian version. Through the movement of Islamic merchants and traders, shatranj reached Far East and Southeast Asia. Here, it came up against other strategy games. Some were very similar to chaturanga, and so chess quickly and seamlessly adapted to local tastes and habits. In China, it became known as shangqi. Still played today, this version foregoes figurative statuettes completely in favor of smooth, flat discs with the Chinese characters for each role inscribed on their surface. The pieces move along the lines of the board rather than within the squares, and castles and rivers further enliven gameplay. However, shangqi remained a popular game, never reaching the same cultural esteem among Chinese literati and imperial circles as other local games. This might be because it was introduced to the region by merchants rather than diplomats or conquerors. It did, however, quickly adapt to many principles that define Chinese military traditions and hierarchies. Generals replaced the king pieces, and cannons and catapults were added to better mirror local war tactics. Materially too, chess sets reflected local crafts. This elephant piece is made of ivory, the most common material employed in India, alongside inlaid wood. Although its surface is now scraggy and cracked, originally it would have been polished to a smooth shine to highlight the ivory's own qualities and the skilled detail of the carving. Makers in West Asia and North Africa preferred stone, likely because their general arid climates made rare resources all the more treasured. In China, on the other hand, expensive sets use jade, bone, and lacquered wood. These boards and pieces boasted their makers' technological knowledge and abilities, as well as their available materials. Jade especially was associated with scholarly objects, like pen rests and opium pipes, and was, at times, valued even more than gold or silver. A jade chess set would not only be an object of great luxury, but also a symbol of social status, erudition, and wealth. It would take another two centuries before chess sets started being produced in Europe, with the first material evidence dating from the 10th century. The game was first imported from the Islamic Umayyad dynasty of North Africa and the Iberian Peninsula, and it quickly spread across the continent. As in China, the pieces and their roles were adapted to suit European social hierarchies. Bishop pieces were introduced instead of elephants to acknowledge the political role of Christianity, prevalent across Europe. Similarly, a queen replaced the counselor besides the king. This marks a more accurate representation of Western courtly hierarchies, but it also raises questions about the agency of women in royal spaces. While we can only speculate about their political reach, we do know that European women often play chess. Many enjoy the intellectually stimulating activity and sometimes commission beautiful sets. At the same time, treatises about the rules and strategic virtues of chess also began to circulate on the continent. These were primarily based on Persian and Arabic texts on the same subject, which suggests that literature on games and game theory was also reaching Europe. But some things were lost in translations. As pieces were transformed into more relevant social roles, appearances and symbolisms were often overlapped and confused. For example, chariot pieces morphed into rooks, ostensibly to mirror medieval fortifications and their function in European warfare. However, this was probably encouraged by the imprecise, purely sonic transliteration of the Arabic rook, chariot, to the Latin rucus, meaning castle or fortress. Further muddling matters was the stylized shape of the Arabic chariot pieces. Their crenellated top, which sought to represent the heads of the horses pulling the chariot, was likely misinterpreted as the outline of battlements. The potential for the elephant pieces to connote strength and immovability still piqued the European imagination. While elephants were common in Eastern and Central Asia, both in combat and everyday contexts, Europe encountered them much more rarely and often only in military conflict with North African or Asian powers. For this reason, elephants remained alluring emblems of distant cultures, able to perform feats of almost supernatural muscle. We can see this fascination in the way that, sometimes, rook statuettes were composed of a tower strapped on an elephant's back. Our elephant piece, on the other hand, was carved with ease and familiarity. Its makers captured the swaying step so characteristic of elephants, their swinging tail, and, in the subtle placement of the statuette's legs, even the pace of their wartime stampedes. All of these details firmly situate this object in an Indian context, with none of the fantastical Orientalist attributions we see in Europe. The many ways chess adapted to its surroundings as it traveled revealed the pliability of the game, but also its fundamentally representative function. For us now, chess appears simply as a game, but for centuries, the board, the pieces, the rules were all inherently socially significant symbols. Shrunk down to the size of a tabletop game, the Indian Raja, the Persian Shah, the Chinese general, and the European king and queen all possessed the same agency on the chessboard as in their respective cultural and political settings. Chess, thus, exceeds the status of a mere game, no longer only reflecting society, but actively staging its social rules. The military and imperial hierarchies represented in chess allowed players to break down, practice, and perform behaviors that dictated and defined social dynamics. This can be said of games at large. We can frame them not as fruits of culture, but primary conditions of culture itself, a way to shape and test social interactions. If we consider the ancient tradition of games, the earliest archaeological evidence dating back to ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia, we can clearly see this fundamentally human facet of play. Recognizing this dismantles some of the arbitrary categorizations of modern Western thought. Scholarship, both historical and art historical, often sidesteps everyday objects and practices. Traditions like chess are wrongly dismissed as belonging to a less significant tier of material evidence and human behavior. It also challenges the understanding of leisure as a social criteria that measures wealth, development, and ultimately modernity on European scales. Everything that occurs beyond the geographical and political borders of Europe, and which does not fit into the narrow Western definition of modernity, culture, or intellect, is thought unmodern and of little to no cultural and intellectual value. The convoluted path and changes that chess undertook before becoming its current Western version reveals just how much of it, as a practice and tradition, stems from Asian society and thought. Our ivory elephant, therefore, highlights the irony behind our tendency to associate chess to Western intellect and popularity, pointing instead to the great debt we owe to cultures all across the world. Pausing on its hierarchic and performative role, we can also begin to appreciate the ways in which repeated traditions impact social interactions, while often concealing their agency. We may find little direct comparison between the bishops or kings and the Indian elephants on our chessboards and our everyday lives. But perhaps the next time we pick up a chess set, lay out its pieces, and prepare to play, we can begin to deconstruct these ideas, building up for centuries.
Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofronievich. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.